question is meant quite naive. If somebody is coming to this conference who never heard about what you just talked about, with a kind of non-pre-informed view, and not like me and many other on the panel here, maybe too much already impregnated with the art history of the Duchampian story and with too much insider talk about Duchamp. There's a lot of insider talk, which is very hard to get for anybody outside the Duchampian community. What would this person think what the ready-made century is about? The first thing you may do is just Google what the ready-made is, you know. And what comes up? It's the most stupid thing you can do, you know, but everybody does it, so why don't try? And you get a more significant result than you would expect for the topics of this conference. Because there seem to be two coexisting meanings of the word ready-made. The one meaning is evidently related to the domain of visual arts and particularly to the work of Marcel Duchamp, as Bernd has been explaining. The other meaning is more broad, but in a way it seems to be related to consumer goods which are not made to measure, which are not made on demand. Instead, they are prefabricated, they are ready to be bought off the shelf. They are commodities on stock waiting for a customer either in a physical shop or online. Thank you. So the second meaning for our conference is as important as the first one. And the question now when you look at this image is, why are there so many kind Indian ladies? In 2012, 5 years ago, I was in Bangalore to give a talk at the Srishti School of Art and Design, exactly about the topic of contemporary ready-made artistic practices. So you see, it's occupying me for a while, and it was around that time that the first ideas and also our discussions started. Right before entering the lecture hall, on the street, this sign was catching my eyes. And I am sure that the shop owner never heard a word about Marcel Duchamp's ready-mades, but in India, the wages are so low that made-to-measure clothing is quite affordable also for the middle class compared to the luxury status which such tailor-made clothings have in the Western societies. So in India, the word ready-mades, even without a line in between and even with a large R, is still a kind of common word for prefabricated fashion. That's why there are so many Indian ladies in the Google search image, which I was been showing you. As we see, these two coexisting meanings of the word ready-made, which you both find in the dictionary, have no homogeneous distribution on a global scale. We are in the house of world cultures, so maybe it's important to say that. And there are different aspects prevailing depending on the region of the world where you are, depending on the social and economical context, and depending whether you're on the street in Bangalore or you're here in the house of world cultures at this conference. So, this is also true in a historical perspective. And in the mid-19th century, long before Europe, US America was on the forefront of mass standardization in custom, in commodities and in textile production. What you see here is the rhymed and illustrated advertisement for ready-made clothing bought, which you can could have bought at the time in Boston in 1854. And the lines which you can read say that this is the splendid stock in trade comprising rich clothing all ready-made. And since the 19th century, fashion and also furniture, something that has still to be researched more, are the two main consumer goods pre-produced in mass quantity. The tailor and the cabinet maker no longer wait for the customer's order, but they have a certain choice of models and various sizes ready-made on stock. The customer can take home the object of his choice right away if he pays. At the same time, these craftsmen making these commodities are no longer tailors and cabinet makers. They are no longer part of the guild, but they are pre-industrial manufacture workers, and they are subjects to an extreme early capitalist exploitation. In contrast to this exploitation, on the other hand, the rhymed advertisement, which you see up here in the third line, gives the promise of social equality for the customers who can buy all clothing of the same quality, of every fashion, rank, and grade. So this dilemma between capitalist exploitation and the promise of social equality is with us since more than 100 years, since the mid-19th century. The same promise is even part of the origin of Fordism. Ford wanted a motor car for a price which the factory workers producing the car could afford. Before, motor cars were luxury goods, and with the Ford Model T, they became also at a reasonable price for workers available. And on the other hand, Ford and the Fordism is a landmark in the further development of the ready-made consumer good. While in the year 1913, he introduced the moving assembly line for standardized low-cost motor cars sold from stock instead of being produced on demand. On the other side, they all looked the same. They all had the color black, and they all had the same kind of standardized motor and equipment. Interestingly, in 2013, there was not much rumor about the centennial of Fordism. This brings us to the next question, why the century? By this very shortly drafted here development of the ready-made commodities since the mid-19th century, the handmade objects of painting and of sculpture, and with these objects also the whole domain of visual arts, have been completely separated from the process of industrialization. In a world of prefabricated, ready-made consumer goods, works of art still keep up a touch of handmade uniqueness. Uniqueness either by their visible materiality or by their conceptual construction, including various degrees of what Walter Benjamin called Differenzierungen und Stufungen der Echtheit. We could name it today maybe shades of uniqueness. And so we are approaching the century question with this letter. 100 years from now, Marcel Duchamp has put this separation between industrial produced ready-made objects and the rest of the uniqueness prevailing in the visual arts into question. He has taken the object ready-made instead of building a work of art with his hand, and at the same time he found, which is very important for us, the word ready-made to denominate this practice. And he changed the noun, he changed the adjective, ready-made jacket, to a noun, the ready-made, which is a very important shift. And even the word ready-made itself is ready-made. Duchamp had, as we see in this letter, to cross the Atlantic, leaving Paris on the outbreak of the First World War, arriving in New York in 1915, to find this word ready-made, which he then picked up to denominate a practice he had already begun in Paris a year earlier. So the objects have been there, and the name to the designation came when he came to the US. A momentum of intercultural translation seems to be part of this choice of the word. Duchamp says, "Il m'a intéressé comme mot," in a later interview. Ready-made interested me as a word. I was interested in the word, in this strange combination of two words. So, this is hopping. In April 1917, and we're getting closer to the reason of the centennial, the notorious Fountain, which you see here, signed with the acronym R.Mutt, was rejected by the New York Independents. Only a few close friends of Duchamp were in the know about his specific role in the game. It was not entered with his name, it was not signed by him. The incident did not raise a larger public debate, and very importantly, the word ready-made remained absolutely unmentioned in the few articles in the press at the time. The object was never exhibited. It was refused by the Independents. It was soon after lost, and the only evidence we have of it is this subtle black and white photograph taken by Alfred Stieglitz, printed in this magazine, The Blind Man, published 1 month after the incident. And it shows the fountain or the urinoir on a pedestal, which is part of a big misunderstanding going on for 100 years, because it shows a situation staged only for taking the photograph. The object fountain was never exhibited that way. So that is part of the whole century story where ready-mades have been exhibited, or rather not been exhibited. They have not been very much exhibited in the first half of the ready-made century. They were more or less known only to insiders. This is a funny story, much too complex to tell. I will go into details about that more in my hopefully soon forthcoming book. And you can see how truly Duchamp is in not giving any kind of early fame to these objects, talking in an interview in 1965, that actually, quote Duchamp, "they were a very personal experiment that I had never expected to show to the public." And then comes this second wonderful phrase, "but I'm very pleased to the response to them." 50 years after the fact, in the mid-century of the ready-made, so to say, Duchamp's by then lost and discarded original objects have become a major reference for 20th century art, and they continue to be a reference for 21st century's art. And I will not tell this story of the first half of this century now, as I say, but it is one of the most amazing processes of something almost forgotten, lost, vanished, that suddenly happens to be in the center of the most contemporary discussions. And by 2004, the fountain came top of a poll of 500 arts experts to vote on the most influential work of modern art. And if you see the line in BBC news here below, which I put a little ring around, Duchamp shocked the art establishment when he took the urinal, signed it, and put it on display in 1917. This makes crazy every researcher who has been trying to show that it was just the other way around. so many fake news in one sentence. The urinal was not put on display, as I tried to explain, in 1917. At the time, nobody knew about Duchamp's role, and he did not sign it, at least not with his own name. So far about history. What's left here for a two-day symposium to say after so many books about the topic? The symposium will be situated in the gap which has opened since the visual arts and the production of commodities and consumer goods separated sometime in the 19th century, as I wanted to show in the beginning of my talk. From a strictly contemporary perspective, this was a very strong aspect for Berndt and Katinka. From a strictly contemporary aspect, we will investigate the activities in and around this gap from which Duchamp's ready-mades emerged 100 years ago. The symposium will not continue the endless stream of interpretations provoked by Duchamp's gestures in art history, in philosophy, in sociology, and in aesthetics, and even sometimes in theology. I found texts about it. Instead, we will try to approach the ready-made century as an ongoing process, as an interweaving of art and life, as an amalgam of high and low going on until this very day. Since the 1960s, what René Bloch called the ready-made boomerang in an exhibition in 1990 keeps on coming back every 10 to 15 years. From Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes to Jeff Koons's vacuum cleaners, from Ilan Sturtevant's to Sherry Levine's reappropriations of Duchamp's ready-made. It would be possible to do a rewriting of Arthur Danto's notorious book titled Transfiguration of the Commonplace under the new paradoxical title The Commodification of the Ready-Made. And I'm not going to list any more artists. Other people have been doing this, including John Armleder, who does this wonderful accumulation of objects he bought from the shelf following his kind of colleagues, which he listed up in the shopping list he gave to his gallerists. It's called Ready-Mades of the Century and has the subtitle Don't Do It. An ironic tribute to the countless variants and derivates of Duchamp's ready-mades, Armleder collected these objects, and he expectedly, his warning, don't do it, addressed to his fellow artist, remained without consequences, as we see in this symposium. And most of the practices of the already made in this symposium do not explicitly refer to Duchamp's ready-made. Only the first panel does a kind of historic overview. But to the contemporary commodity culture. So the question we're trying to approach is what shifts in meaning do we find in the concepts of the contemporary ready-made under the postmodern, postcolonial, and post-media conditions. For the artists in the symposium, the contemporary ready-made is not another genre in the classical canon of the arts. That means painting of the 20th century or 21st century, sculpture of the 21st century, drawing of the first 21st century, and ready-mades of the 21st century. That's not the way it works. This would be a very kind of simplicistic approach. But it is a cross-disciplinary method or approach with often different principles of authorship and originality. The huge diversification of the ready-made principle 100 years after Duchamp seems to link back to the historical openness of the term, which I wanted to introduce to you by this stupid Google search. The interference of the two meanings allows for a constant updating and expansion and interference between these two meanings. Circulations of capital, globalization of markets, establishing transnational brand identities, and the new post-industrial processes for producing goods which are no longer prefabricated, but which are delivered on demand and just in time. These are the central topics for altruistic practices that revisit the ready-made in the 21st century. Art, by this process, becomes part of a feedback loop. On the one hand, it explores or critiques the global circulation of goods and the cognitive capitalism. On the other hand, it serves the market capitalization of even those ideas and brands as art merchandise by what Marsha Buskirk calls rebranding the ready-made. While in the industry and the promises of the digital customization as individualization take place, and while in conceptual art, often a kind of dematerialization described in the 60s is now kind of even less material than ever before by being, for example, performative without any kind of material trace. The question when something is finally ready in both fields, in the art and in the industry, seems to be more open than ever. So the ongoing currentness of the ready-made principle reaching far beyond Duchamp's time is based on the continuing state of tension between these two meanings, between industrial and artistic production, or more generally, a tension between the unabated need for individuality and for the formatting of that need by capitalist production of commodities, which is ever progressing since Duchamp's time. This brings me to the final and most delicate question. Why didn't we invite any female artists for these panels? There is one possibility. The curator is a male ignorant chauvinist. It's up to you to judge this. Another possibility would be something vaguely Freudian, nebulous, like ready-mades are typical male strategy, disembodied way of giving birth. You know, I don't want to get into that either. It's certainly no longer relevant in a kind of so-called post-gender artistic practice today. The truth is a very simple one. Several female artists which we invited would have loved to give a presentation, but none of them was finally available at this moment in time. So maybe another conference to do about that. Thank you, Bernd Scherer. Thank you, Annette Bhagwati, somewhere in this room, with whom I shared an intense and productive one-year collaboration. Thank you, Veronica Google, who joined us in the last months. And thank you to all the chairs and artists and respondents who will share with us the 1.5 days of this conference. And last not least, thanks to my employee, my kind of home base, the Hochschule für Grafik and Buchkunst Leipzig, for a sabbatical in winter 2015-16, which made the extensive research for this conference and for my forthcoming book possible so far.